So, everyone, I was browsing through some random articles on the internet, and I was reading about this guy that lives in Seattle, Washington, called Bike Batman. Has anyone ever heard of Bike Batman before? No? Oh, you've heard of Bike Batman? What? All right. Well, anyways, this guy that they call Bike Batman in 2015, he's a bike enthusiast. We have a couple of those around here, but he was looking to buy a bike. He was on Craigslist. He sees this ad and he's like, wow, these pictures are kind of taken in a sketchy place. You can't see where they're from. He doesn't know anything about the bike. He's just wanting to make some quick cash. And so he's like, this is kind of weird. Then he starts to look on a bike forum and he sees that the bike was actually stolen about 2 weeks prior to that. And so when he is on his way there to meet this guy to supposedly buy the bike, he calls the police. He says, hey, I found this guy. I have definitive proof that this bike is stolen. He's trying to pawn it off to me. So can you guys come along, right? So then he meets this guy. The police aren't there yet. And he gives him two options, right? He's like, either you can hand the bike over to me now, or you can wait for the police when they get here in a minute, and they can arrest you. The guy handed the bike over to him. This guy has now, for the last 2 years, been slowly cleaning up Seattle, because every year there's 1,500 to 2,000 bike thefts. And that's a big deal to him because he's a bike enthusiast. He knows how much bikes matter. So he wants to be able to reunite people with their bikes. And it's hard and it's tough. In 2 years, he's got about 50 bikes that have been stolen back, which is a large number, but doesn't make a big dent in that total number of bikes that are being stolen. But he notes someone was interviewing him. He's anonymous. No one really knows what his name is. But they're like, why do you do it? What is the reason for you to even like risk yourself to get back some stolen bike? And he's like, it feels really good to be able to reunite people with their bikes. There are people that it means so much to. This hunk of steel and paint is worth much more than the price tag. And then he goes on to talk about how some of the bikes that he's recovered have been really expensive, thousands of dollars, these great road bikes that you can go really fast in, and then some of them have been really cheap, worth probably about $30. One he returned to some 70-year-old guy that just rode it back and forth from the grocery store. But with everyone, he knows from his own personal experience that there is value in that bike and that possession. And so he's willing to dedicate his life to bringing other people's valuable possessions back to them. So in the same way, right, when we're thinking about this text that we just read, Jesus is telling us that by nature of us just possessing something, it's going to become a treasure. It's going to become a greater and greater value in our daily lives. So much so, right, that when we lose it, whether that be your car that breaks, whether that be your bike that gets stolen, whether that be your Xbox that gets the red ring of death, whatever that is, because we're using it, because we have it, we're vesting value in it. As much or as little as we're willing to admit, there is something in our heart that is becoming attached to these things. So Jesus is telling us that, and it's not entirely unfamiliar. Whether you grew up in a Christian background or not, you've probably heard something to this effect, right? Hey, possessions are temporary. Invest in things that are more eternal. That much is true, but Jesus wants us to look deeper than the surface and even deeper than what random people are going to say, because he says that there's a different issue going on than what we assume, than what we understand. So if I had to summarize this passage in a single sentence, if I had to summarize what Jesus' intent is in this, Jesus is trying to say that if God is truly our Father, we're going to give him every bit of our desires and there isn't going to be room left for anything else. So before we start delving into the passage, let's kind of understand the context and even the things that we already know. So we're in the Sermon on the Mount. We're kind of on the tail end. We've been working through it for about 2.5 months. now. And so in the start of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus starts talking about what state, what place does your heart need to be in order to have a relationship with God. Ultimately, right, he concludes that you need to be humbled. You need to be aware of your brokenness. You need to be seeking God's help and assistance. And then to show them why they even needed to have their heart in that place in the first place, he then, for the majority of chapter 5, starts to explain the law, right? And all of these people listening, and even us, right, we have some concept of what God's law and standards are. And Jesus isn't reinterpreting the law, but he's actually explaining, hey, it goes a lot deeper than you want to say that it does, right? It's not just a surface level thing. It's a heart issue that fundamentally makes you unable to meet that standard. And so now we're in chapter 6. And in chapter 6, Jesus transitions from not just talking about the law, but what does it look like if you're truly a child of God? If God is your father, if you have actually been brought into a relationship with him, right? You've gotten past this sense of brokenness and this sense of you've humbled yourself before God, and you're in a relationship with him. What does it look like to live like that? What does it look like to live in light of something more permanent? And so 3 weeks ago, Chris started by going through prayer, giving, and fasting, right? Looking at things not in light of what you can glean from others, by how holy you can look by praying in front of people or by giving an abundance of money or whatever else. But ultimately, that this is pointing to the fact that God is up there and that God has very different standards and understanding and analysis of everything that we're doing. And so it's all about our heart. It's all about what we do in private, right? He says, hey, you got to go and you got to shut your door so that no one knows what you're saying to God as you're praying, because that's what's important, right? That you're in submission to God and that you understand that God is the only thing that matters. And then last week, Chris went through anxiety, right? Which is the section that immediately follows this and actually builds on a lot of the things that Jesus talks about here, where he says, hey, if God is truly your father, if you're truly entrusting everything to him, you're not going to worry about the future. Because God tells you that he's going to provide, right? You wake up every day and you say, hey, I need food to eat, I need clothes, I need any number of things, right? But God is your father, and God transcends all of these circumstances. And he literally and directly promises that in all of these instances where you would tend to be worried, you don't need to worry, because God says the only focus of your life needs to be on him. And so right now we're backtracking back into this section, 19 through 24, that's going to talk specifically about possessions, right? And the idolatry of these possessions is what leads ultimately to the anxiety that we learned about and talked about last week. But this in and of itself is definitely a standalone section and something that I think we need to buckle in and understand, but is also one of the easiest things to let coast under the radar, because we want to say, hey, I'm not a materialist, I don't have a $1 million house, and so therefore I don't idolize possessions. But we're going to see that if even a shred of anxiety exists, if even a shred of misplaced priorities exists, it's a sign that we actually are idolizing possessions in all kinds of devious ways. So I would say that Jesus kind of has three separate things that he says in this. And so my outline of this section would be first, right, that Jesus tells us we need to be gathering treasures that last. Second, he says that our inward values are going to show outwardly, that people are going to be able to see what's actually going on in our hearts, despite what we want to tell ourselves. And then thirdly, that there's no such thing as being on the fence, that there's no in between for a right, whether you trust in God or whether you trust in the world. There's nothing kind of in this gray area where you can have a little bit of both, but you need to be committed to one or the other. And so our first section is just that you need to be gathering treasures that last. So I'm just going to read 6, 19 through 21 one more time, just so we can have it fresh in our minds and be picturing what it is that Jesus is trying to tell us and not coming up with things on our own, right? So Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So Jesus starts this by trying to give us, right? He gives us an affirmative command and then a negative command. Do this, do not do this. So he starts by saying, hey, do not store up for yourself earthly possessions. So even talking about bike Batman, right? Intuitively, whether we say that we're religious, whether we have a Christian background, whether we have a Buddhist background, at least to an extent, we see that things are temporary. Whether they could be taken away from us by someone stealing them and them having it for themselves, or by them fading away, right? He says moth and rust destroying things, right? Time eventually is going to make anything deteriorate. It's going to make your house deteriorate. It's going to make your bike or your car or whatever it may be start to fall apart. And so we kind of understand that. And Jesus knows that. The people listening would even know that and relate to that and probably be saying, yeah, that's true, Jesus. I think that I agree with you, right? So then Jesus goes to he flip-flops it, right? He says, hey, you can't just not do this. That's not enough. You need to actually store up treasures in heaven. You need to pursue things that last. So this is where it starts to get a little tricky with the background that we have and even that they had, right? So you're thinking in your mind, all right, so I can't store up for myself a car, I can't store up for myself a house, right? I can't grab onto these things and hold on to these things. But then he says, hey, you need to store up heavenly possessions, right? Things that are from God that last eternally. But when Jesus is saying this, and we're going to see at the very end of this section in verse 21, he's not necessarily talking about a gold-plated bike as opposed to a shiny, or as opposed to just a normal bike here on earth, right? He's not saying you need to have a heavenly bike as opposed to an earthly bike. He is actually pointing back to the same thing that he's been pointing to in so many other sections in chapter 6. Right? He says that since God is our Father, God rewards us in ways that really right now even we can't necessarily conceptualize very well. Because he's our Father and he knows what we need, right? All the time when people bring up God as our Father, the comparison is parenthood, right? Where you have to tell your child, hey, I know that you think you want that entire bag of candy, but ultimately, right, that's not good for you. And God is like that, but also God promises that there's going to be an abundance of joy. Because Jesus says in verse 21, right, for where your treasure is, your heart is also. Jesus, when he's talking about possessions and this do and do not, ultimately the importance is not what you have in your hand and the fact that you have a bike sitting in your house or a car sitting in your driveway or even having a house to begin with. He's saying that it's all about the condition of your heart. If God is your Father and your heart is not directed at God, what good is that to you, and are you even having a relationship with God in the first place? So Jesus is trying to redirect this conversation and talk about what it really looks like to follow God. And so when he says storing up possessions or heavenly possessions that last, I think that 1 Timothy chapter 6 is going to kind of give us an indicator. This is just an instance where Paul uses the exact same terminology intentionally to kind of show us what it looks like to live this out of storing up heavenly possessions. So I'm just going to read verses 17 through 19 real quick. But this is just a quick caution from Paul to Timothy, where he says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. I'm not trying to jump entirely out of this Matthew chapter 6 passage, but I think that looking at these side by side really gives us an indicator, right? Paul is saying, just as Jesus is saying, that this storing up treasures is ultimately doing the things that God desires, right? Being obedient and having your heart set on the right things, just like he's been talking about all through the Sermon on the Mount. But not because those things in and of themselves are going to get us said bike or get us said car or whatever else, but ultimately because it's building a firm foundation. It's giving us not only assurance in our own personal future, but right, it's rooting us in this truth that we need to be solely worshiping God and solely focused on God. And that's the only thing that can give us the true joy and security that our hearts are seeking as we're gathering up possessions impulsively, right? It's this tendency that we naturally have where we say, I need security, I need joy, I need peace. And so this car that's going to give me freedom is going to give me joy and security and peace because I don't have to rely on others, or this house or whatever it may be. Jesus is trying to redirect the conversation so our focus isn't on what is it that you have in your hand, right? Because there's not this threshold of if it's worth less than $10, it can't possibly be an idol. The problem is that your hearts are going to crave and look for something regardless of how much monetary worth it has or regardless of how little monetary worth it has. And I, again, right, this is something that's familiar. This is something that you've probably heard before. I have this tendency. I grew up in a household. My parents are Christian, and they would always tell me, hey, you can't idolize money. You can't idolize possessions. These things aren't going to make you happy. And so I have this impulse, right, whenever I talk about anything, I would say that one of the most valuable things that I own is my car. Because it's right, it represents security, it represents freedom. I don't have to rely on others. And so when I look at my life and I say, what are things that possibly could be treasures that I'm trying to store up here? I'm going to make this list, and then I'm going to come to the conclusion, well, I guess these could be idols, but I know the truth that I'm not supposed to be trusting in. And what Jesus is going to show us in this next section is that's a lie. That's a way that we're trying to kind of twist the truth and convince ourselves that that's not a factor, but truly that is. So as we think about this first part, just ask yourself, what are really the most important things in my life right now? What are the things throughout my week or throughout my day that demand the most time, that demand the most thought or the most effort? And lots of those things could be good, right? Don't neglect putting them on that list. But I just encourage you to think about that, because as Jesus unpacks this, we're going to see that there's a lot more depth and that there's a lot more importance and value that we're putting in these things. So now in the second section, in verses 22 through 23, Jesus is going to show us that our inward values show outwardly. So I'm just going to read verses 22 through 23 another time. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? And so this is definitely the most confusing part of what Jesus says, but also the most pivotal part, because it's getting at something that, or getting to a place that we don't really want to go to, right? So in the first part, Jesus is talking to all of us, and he's appealing to something that we already seem to know and seem to understand, and that certainly the Pharisees and any Jewish person there would seem to know and seem to understand, right? Hey, earthly treasures are temporary, heavenly treasures are permanent. You need to go after heavenly treasures because those things are good, and your heart needs to be oriented towards those. Okay, cool, check. That's something that I do. That's what most of the crowd would say, and that's what impulsively, right, when I read this, I would say. But Jesus starts out with this metaphor. He says that the eye is the lamp of the body. and that's a little confusing and it's a little weird. I remember reading this and I was like, okay, how do I need to be processing this metaphor? Do I need to know how like the retina works and how everything is processed? Ultimately though, there's a parallel in Luke 11 where Jesus uses the same kind of example. But ultimately in both of those instances, Jesus is attempting to just point to a very simple thing. It's not super complicated. It's not super rooted in biology or whatever else. He's just trying to say that your eyes show what the rest of your soul, what the rest of your body is like. It works like a lamp. It illuminates what's inside of you, and it also helps you see what's outside of you, right? So it shows where your desires are directed, and it shows how deeply rooted things are inside of you. It's that crisscross between your internal and external kind of life. It's the panel or the window in between. And so Jesus is trying to get them to understand as a transition, right? Hey, your heart is invested in these things, these physical things that you have, that you possess, that you want to store up. And so we need to start, keep looking deeper, right? Because the solution is not to get rid of these physical things. Lots of people try this. You can look all throughout history, even before Jesus's time. And people thought that the best solution was to get rid of every possible possession they could have and swear that they would never own anything. But that didn't solve the problem because their heart still craved to love things above God. Their heart still sought security in other things rather than God. And so Jesus wants us to be looking at our hearts now with this phrase, the eye is the lamp of the body, right? So after he says that, he says, so if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. So Jesus starts using this light versus darkness thing as opposed to heavenly versus earthly now. And when we hear that, we should tune in to write the same thing, right? Jesus is using light to represent the things of God and the things of heaven. And he's using darkness to represent the things of the world, right? The temporary things that he was talking about earlier. And so when he says, right, if your eye is healthy, if your desires are doing what they're supposed to be doing, then your entire body is going to be full of light. Your entire body is going to be full of God, right? So he's been talking about what it looks like to be a follower of God, what it looks like to live as a child of God. And so he's trying to tell them that if you live a life that only craves God and nothing else, then that's a true representation, right, of the fact that internally you are in right relationship with God, that your heart and soul are filled with who God is, really, right, filled with good works, filled with loving God, filled with constant prayer and constant communication with him, right? He's trying to tell them that we can look at external things, that your external desires and even your daily actions and see indicators that you follow God. But also, he flips the coin, right? He says, but if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. So there's an opposite side to it as well, right? We can be craving worldly things, and you're going to be able to see from the outside what my inside looks like, right? If my life revolves around work, if my life revolves around a hobby, right, or whatever else it may be, all you have to do is ask my neighbor, all you have to do is ask my friend, all you have to do is ask, for many of you, right, your spouse, what it is that dictates what your life is about. And some days the answer might be different, right? Some days they might say, hey, they clearly value God a lot. And then other days, in times of crisis, they might say, hey, they clearly value the world or their house or their reputation in the neighborhood or whatever else it may be a lot, right? And so Jesus paints this black and white picture, right? Light and dark. Your heart is either going to crave God or it's going to crave the world. But then, just like in the last section, at the very end, he tries to refine it because we want to live in this world of simplicity when Jesus talks about our hearts, right? Where we can just wake up and say, all right, I follow God, check that off the list. All right, we're good to go. Tell me what's next so I can modify my behavior some more. But, right, in verse 23, at the very end, the last sentence, he said, if then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? And so when Jesus is talking about this, he's saying, hey, if there's even a slight indication of the fact that there's darkness in your desires, in your passions, then there's actually a lot more going on underneath. This is just the little bit that's bubbling up out of your heart and soul. You're filled to the brim with a desire for the world and with a desire for temporary things. And so even if you might try to justify away these small passions and these small desires that take place in your life, really you're going to see that it's a much bigger deal, that it's a much bigger issue as you think about your life deeper, as you really start to truly understand and see things the way that God, your Father, sees things in your heart. And I think that is just incredible, right? Because Jesus doesn't want anyone that's listening to arrive at this place of comfort where they can check off every box, because that's what even I, right, when I read this, am expecting. I want Jesus to list the achievable standard that I can hit. Right, what is the bare minimum that I can do to be here, that I can sign off on my list? And Jesus is saying, hey, it's not that simple. Put away your checklist and understand that this is a much deeper issue than right what you want it to be. It's not as simple as you seem to desire. So going back to even our own list of things that take priority in our lives, start to think about what almost made the list, or even what's on the list, but as you kind of think about the outward expression of your desires, it seems to be growing more and more. So for example, right, my car is probably the most valued thing in my life. But ultimately, right, just like Jesus is saying, what my eyes are focused on, what clearly my intent is, show that there's a far greater heart issue. So my car is old. It's got 260-some thousand miles on it, and right, it represents security. It represents freedom. It represents even like liberation from having to rely on other people to get places or to do things or to move things or whatever else it may be. And so a constant concern of mine is that it will break down. And so I'm constantly checking fluids. I'm constantly just, you know, doing a spot check to see if anything's broken or if anything's falling off. But ultimately, right, if something does go wrong, there's a lot of things on my list that I would say are priorities that are going to fall off that list when my car has something wrong with it. To the point, right, if I wake up in the morning and I know that my car is broken, I'm going to try and fix my car before I'm going to read God's word. Ultimately, right, even if to some extent, even if my car was horribly broken and the only way I could fix it was by investing 6 hours, maybe I would even skip church or skip time with other believers in community, right? And so asking those same questions of yourself, what are ways that I see kind of maybe small desires or small tendencies or small priorities in my life? What are those a sign of, or how does that look deeper down in my soul? And I think the indicator is really going to be what happens when trouble comes, what happens when my bike gets stolen, what happens when my car breaks down, what happens when there's something wrong with my house, who is ultimately getting the priority in my life. That really, right, just like Jesus is saying, your eyes, your desires, your intent are going to be communicating the actual heart priority that those have. And there's days where we can trick ourselves and say, hey, no, actually, it's pretty simple. You know, God is my priority, and you know, I don't, you know, interrupt it for 2 months. There's just a couple of things. And he's like, no, those couple of things show that your heart is broken and jacked up and focused on everything that's wrong. And so, right, that leads us to the third and final section of this passage, right, where Jesus says that there is no such thing as being on the fence, right? So this whole time Jesus is talking, and we're trying to go through, well, we and his listeners, right, and the Pharisees and Jews, we're trying to do these mental acrobatics so we can say, well, Jesus, you're trying to tell me that I value possessions too much, but I don't actually. Right, and every time Jesus is trying to sweep their feet out from under them and say, hey, this is more complex than you want it to be. It's not as simple as just saying, check, it's off the box, I'm good to go. And so I'm just going to read verse 24 for us again. So he says, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money, right? And so Jesus, building off of everything that he's said already, he says that there's going to come a point, and maybe it may not seem apparent to you now, but in God's eyes, with the way that God deals with things, there is a point where whatever takes the most precedence in your life is going to become apparent. And that, right, that thing already takes the most precedence in your life, but it may not appear really until the end, until, right, the rubber meets the road, until something breaks, until something's taken away. So Jesus wants them to ask this question, right? Who am I serving? The reason he wants them to ask this question, and even, right, the intended result is for us to realize that we're not entirely serving God, right? You don't have to read much of the Bible to realize that God says, hey, you're either for me or you're against me. God in his fullness created all things. And so if we're going to say, hey, I love God, that means we need to love God 100% in his entirety. And if we don't, then we're just twisting who God is, right? There's no such thing as a 98% love for God and a 2% love for the world, because that's not who God is. God in his fullness is huge and massive, and extends into many areas of our lives and our desires and our loves. In ways that even sometimes, right, as believers, we don't understand or we don't see. So as he's saying this, he wants people to ask the question and come to the conclusion, right, of who they serve. That's also directed at us, right? As we search our hearts, as we search our desires, as we search our daily rhythms and weeks, what are shreds that contain God, and what are shreds that contain the world, right? Many of us, I know that a lot of these faces I see in church every week, right? Many of us do things really to have communion with God. We read the word, we pray, we go to church. That's amazing, right? And that's even part of Jesus' desire, as he says, store up for yourselves heavenly treasures. But again, right, he says, in the end, you're going to be serving one or the other. So even as I look at my week, and knowing you guys, as you look at your time all throughout the week, what are things that are competing for those affections? What are things that want to be your master? Because if your focus isn't 100% on God, then God really isn't your master, right? He says, hey, you can't have one or the other, right? Because you're going to hate one and love the other, or you're going to be devoted to one and despise the other, right? Your outward actions are going to either be an affirmation of this idol, of this God, of this thing that provides you security, or they're not going to be ultimately. And it doesn't trace down to whether you have a small shred of this or a small shred of that, but it traces down to whether you are fully devoted to God or fully not. And that's I guess, a challenging word, right? Because again, just like Jesus said, that the eye is the lamp of the body, and if there's even a shred of darkness, how deep is that darkness? When I look at my life, especially even right now, the Lord has been great to sanctify me, but the truth is that I am not full of light all the time, that my affections are not 100% on God as he desires, that I am attempting to serve two masters, and in that attempt to serve two, ultimately I'm just serving the world, I'm serving myself, I'm giving into to sin and brokenness, and that's not what God desires, and that's not what God asks. And so it's a sobering reminder, and it's a hard thing to deal with. And Jesus says these things to be hard to pierce to our heart and soul, and to really make us evaluate things. But he doesn't say these to leave us down in the dumps and to leave us down in this ravine of hopelessness and depression. And by now, right, we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount where at every point Jesus shows us that we're inadequate. So maybe you're used to this, right? But even in this admonition and this conviction that comes from the ways that we tend to idolize possessions, there is still hope and there is still promise. And the hope is very dynamic. It's not as simple as sometimes people say, right? We have to be careful that the gospel isn't reduced in our lives, right? Every time that we end a sermon, every time that we end a teaching time, we talk about the main reality of the gospel, that Jesus came to this earth that he died on the cross to pay the price for our sins. He died specifically for our idolatry and the fact that we find security in possessions, that I find security in my car, that people find security in their house. He died for that specific purpose and covered the price of it. But he didn't just stay dead. When Jesus died, he didn't just cross out the consequences of my sin and leave me neutral before God. But after 3 days, he rose again, and he conquered death. He beat this thing that has a vice on us every single day as humans. And through that, right, beating death, he gave us the ability to live a new life. Right, to not just be passive, to not just float around in simple existence, but to actually beat this thing that had been a vice for us for so long with his help. And that's really a truth that I feel like I constantly need to be called back to. We're approaching about 40 minutes, but I want to take you guys to a passage that I've been in for the last few weeks, which is John chapter 15. If we've talked about the Bible in the last few weeks, this has probably been brought up, and it's because it's something that my heart has constantly needed to be called back to and be encouraged in. And so as we think about application, what does it look like to overcome these things that we treasure so much? What does it look like to have our affections fully on God? The answer is not that you can walk away and say, I'm going to try my hardest, I'm going to be really good, I'm going to burn down my house, and I'm going to empty my bank account and throw it in the dumpster. That's not what the application is. Jesus wants us to build us up. Well, Jesus wants to build us up in the truth that he is the only one that we can turn to, and that through him we have victory, not only in the future, not just in eternity, but even right in the here and now. So I'm going to read John chapter 15, verses 1 through 11. We'll close in just a minute. But Jesus says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. Man. What a powerful series of words. And it's Jesus compares us to, him and us, right, to vine and branches. He says, hey, you guys are branches on this tree, on this plant, and your intent, right, is to produce fruit. Ultimately, right, to do what God asks, to be obedient. He says, but the only way that you can produce fruit, the only way that you can obey, the only way that you can have victory over the sin is through Jesus, right? Through me is what he's saying. And man, because, right, Jesus, just like we saw in Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 24, Jesus is trying to build us up in the fact that we are broken, but that he gives us victory. Right, he says in verse 5 of John 15 that without him we can do nothing. And so, right, if we come to the conclusion at the end, man, I idolize worldly possessions a lot. Right, I'm really concerned about the things that I own, the things that are around me. Right, again, the conclusion is not, hey, I'm going to try harder. The conclusion is to turn to Jesus. And when he says abide, right, he means prayer. He means turning to his word. He means repenting and believing every single day. And ultimately, right, Jesus concludes in verse 11. He says, "These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full." Right, that your heart, that your life may be full of light, because that is what Jesus' joy is, that we would be obedient to the Father and right before the Father. And that ultimately, right, that would be something that is projecting outwards. As people look at our eyes that are the lamps of our body and our soul, they see not selfishness, they see not treasure that is rooted in anything around us, but instead they see Jesus. And that is the truth that I'm reminded of often, but need to remind myself of more. And I hope that really, you know, as we think about going from here and really being built up in truth, abiding in Jesus is the only thing that can rid us of this idolatry. It's the only thing that can free us from this. And so I hope that you guys are encouraged by that. And with that, I'm gonna pray us out as we end the sermon time.